Please note, if you're listening to this, you must be 18 years of age or older. This podcast contains adult themes and may include descriptions that listeners could find offensive. Thank you.
Welcome to the Kinky Nerdy Polly Podcast.
Hi, I'm Em.
And I'm G.
And today on the KMP Podcast, we are going to be talking about how to navigate kink with various disabilities and elaborate on concepts such as RAC applied to disability, as well as the concept of crip time. However, we have to give a super warning and disclaimer for this episode, which is G and I are not medical professionals, and anything in this episode should be approached individually, and if engaging in risky activities that may impact your personal health and safety, we recommend consulting a medical professional.
Yes. As I've mentioned in the pre-talk, I have dropped out of college twice. Please do not take medical advice from me.
And I'm not that kind of doctor, or I'm not about to be that kind of doctor.
You're about to be a language doctor.
Yeah, I can perform procedures on languages.
You kind of do.
Yeah, you do.
You diagnosed language, right?
Yeah, basically. I basically have saved
languages. I was going languages. More for the analysis aspect.
Oh, okay. I haven't saved any languages, but those who do save languages, that's really cool. So, now that we probably won't get sued, let's get into this episode.
All right. So, why don't you tell me, what is disability?
So, disability is kind of a broad category of things. And some people who are listening, they might be disabled slash have a disability, whatever language that they prefer to use around that. I will tend towards saying disabled people and such when I am talking in this episode. But to take the Oxford Dictionary definition, a disability is a physical or mental condition that limits a person's movements, senses, or activities. So that's actually quite broad.
Yeah, I think technically I fall under having a disability, even though I don't normally identify as being a disabled person, because I have been diagnosed with chronic depression, which I deal with every day. But I do admit, I do feel some hesitancy, like, using the term...
Like, disabled for yourself. Disabled
for myself, because it feels... It kind of feels like I'm taking space, if that makes sense.
It certainly makes sense, because I've felt this way about other things that I've sort of identified with, or that I found, like, oh, I really match those characteristics or traits, and I don't want to claim that term because... Maybe I'm being too presumptuous or whatever. And like you said, you might be taking up space. But overall, like, you know, chronic depression, mental illness and things like that, those definitely can be disabling. And if it affects your day-to-day activities and, as this says, your movements, senses, or activities, if it's limited because of these conditions, then I think that it's totally fair to say that you are disabled if that's empowering to you. And some people don't think that's particularly empowering. So I do find it, I had to grapple with whether or not I was going to label myself as disabled for a while. So I was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition in 2019, and since then it has progressed. So my doctors have seen evidence of this disease progressing, and I have to be on pretty serious medication. And in addition to the autoimmune condition, I have a number of other conditions that are disabling in some ways, but maybe less disabling. They limit me less than my autoimmune disease does. So I do consider myself to be disabled, and I try to use that in an empowering way, but not everybody does see that label in an empowering way.
All right. Well, now that we've got our dictionary term and out of the way, it looks like next thing in the note is talking about RAC.
Yeah, so RAC is, for those who don't know, I think we talked about this way in the beginning of the podcast in the consent episode, which if we were professional podcasters, Pied Pipers,
we would have that.
We would have that episode for you.
But we're not professional podcasters, Pod Pipers, because... Did I mess that up?
You did. You said Pod Pipers.
Okay. Pied Pipers. Sorry. Because we're not professionals, we don't have that. So
Yes, but to just recap what risk-aware consensual kink is, G, do you want to give kind of an idea of what that type of consent is compared to, like, for example, safe, sane, and...
consensual.
Is that what it is, SS?
C.
Okay, yes.
So yes, so based off taking several kink classes, so safe, sane, consensual I want to go with sort of older model of consent, with the idea being that everything that you do is safe, that you do it with full cognition, the sane part, and obviously consent is important in kink. RAC, which is risk-aware consensual kink, it emphasizes the fact that the stuff that people do in kink is inherently risky. You know, it would be much, like, on a risk level, it would be much better just to, like, stay at home and watch TV than to go out and do kinky stuff. This actually reminds me that, like, you can measure activities in, like, the probability of how likely you are to die.
Oh, wonderful.
And the base measurement is a mort, and you can go to millimorts.
Oh, millimorts. That's a fascinating system.
Yes. I have no idea what the actual statistical math is, but I don't know. Millimorts makes it seem fun.
It does make it seem fun. Yeah, I want to measure my life in millimorts.
Measure your activities in millimorts.
Oh, we're not? Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So it's not like, oh, I'm this much closer to death because I did this thing.
No.
Okay, I got it. It's... just like how, oh, the likelihood, you said.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
So, for example, scuba diving has a higher millimort than just, like, staying on the beach.
That makes total sense to me, yeah. That's an interesting system. So, to elaborate on what you've said about RAC, which is that, you know, activities in kink are inherently risky and we should all be aware of the risks that come with the activities, there's also the risk that come with our beings. So, like, for example, our identities can intersect with kink in a variety of complex ways. And this includes not just identities in terms of, like, gender, race, age, etc., but also in terms of disability. And so if you have a disability or you're playing with someone who has a disability, then your risks are going to look different.
Yes. So, and it also, I think, emphasizes the fact that not everything is under the participant's control. Like, something unexpected could happen. But as long as we are aware of that, as long as we are aware of the risk of the unknown, you know, we can proceed.
Yes. So some highly important scenarios that we want to be aware of with respect to kink and disability. And honestly, these things can apply to anyone, even if they're not disabled, but these are things that might just be at a greater risk, depending on the disability. So we have that, you know, various kinky activities can cause decreased sensation and numbness and tingling, circulation issues. I think of all of those with relationship to rope, but they definitely get pulled into other types of play. There can be blood pressure issues, heart palpitations, joint pain and dislocations, seizures, respiratory issues, even allergies. So, like, I will go into allergies a little bit more later, but I've had allergic reactions in a kink space before. Arthritis, which is something that I also cope with. Previous injuries. I mean, anybody can be injured at any time, whether that's before, during, or after the scene. Hearing and vision issues can also come into play.
Mm-hmm.
So making sure that you have alternative safe words and you're not just relying on someone being able to, for example, hear you, or vice versa, if you need to have different types of ways to auditorily.
Yeah, so I think good examples of, like, other forms of safe wording in quotation marks, even though I'm doing the quotation marks right now with my fingers, this is an audio format.
They can see them in their hearts.
They can see the quotations in their hearts?
Absolutely.
All right. So I think a couple of good alternatives for safe words are stuff like holding on to, like, a ball or a bell. And, you know, if you need to safe word, you can drop the ball or bell, which is a nice sort of visual indication that something, that check-in needs to happen.
Right. And so hearing, vision, and ability to communicate, all of those things can be impacted in a scene that can create or come with additional risks. And also bruising. Some people are more prone to increased bruising.
Yeah.
So again, just really checking in with people about like where they're okay with being bruised and maybe asking how long it takes them to recover. Is there anything they need to do? Or if you're the person who bruises, like, is there anything that you can do to help recover the bruising in case you have a job that you need to go to that you can't have those sorts of things visible, just in case? Because maybe you plan on there not being any bruising, but because you might be hypersensitive to bruising, it might come out accidentally.
Yeah. I think another good example of this is both knife play and violet wand play. You know, you can, as a top, you can kind of get a sense of like what's going to leave marks and what's not going to leave marks, but you cannot say for 100% certainty because there's just too many factors at play. You know, you got to worry, you know, the reasons why somebody's skin might have lasting marks from violet wand play may range everything from like how hydrated they are before they start the scene to the humidity in the air. You know, there's just way too many factors to be able to say with any certainty how long marks are going to last.
Absolutely. And so far we focused a lot on some of these like physical play things and the risks that carry. But I was also thinking about, so restriction to movement is also a physical thing if you have like mobility issues or challenges. But I often think about this in the context of DS or power exchange scenes, even though this can happen in any scene. But I think about kneeling, for example. Kneeling can be very hard for some people, and being able to either accommodate yourself or to speak up that like, oh, I can't kneel on this, you know, maybe I need to incorporate a different tool. Some people get kneeling benches so that way they can remove the pressure off of their knees, for example, or they might need a cushion and things like that. But also other movement-based activities can cause problems like crawling, lying on the floor, getting off and off of a spanking bench. Even wearing a mouth gag can cause issues for some people. Being restrained in certain positions. So this is all, a lot of this that I've just mentioned, a lot of it is from a specific article that I will post in the show notes, which is more comprehensive than what we can go over right now. But it makes me think about, you know, if there's all of these risks in kink, you know, all these potential risks, even if you're not disabled, and then you have these additional risks because you're disabled, or potentially additional risks, do you disclose your disability or not?
I think the answer is it depends a lot. You know, for example, if we consider like my depression to be a disability, I don't think I've ever disclosed that to any random play partner I've picked up at a play party, because to be honest, if I'm being affected by that, that means I'm at home in bed staring at the ceiling. So that's not really going to affect pickup play in any manner. Mm-hmm. So,
and your mileage may vary on this one, because other people who have chronic depression might have severe memory issues that could impact their ability to retain information that is necessary in a scene, for example.
Oh yeah, that's why I write down notes about a scene before I do any scene.
And that's a good practice for a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that like a lot of these tools can be used even if you're not disabled.
Yes.
So yeah, I agree, G. It depends on the type of disability. It depends on the type of scene that you're doing, for example. So maybe, you know, I have chronic migraines, and maybe I don't think that I need to disclose that. You know, every time I go into a scene with a new person, might not be on the top of my list of like medical conditions to mention. But if I'm having a scene where there might be like strong smells or strong lighting, for example, that might be an instance where I'd be like, oh, by the way, I have chronic migraines, sometimes these things can trigger it.
Yes.
That also might be a time to remember, like, I'm going to keep these meds on me.
I mean, I think this is also one of those things where it's incumbent on the top to be aware of, like, especially if you're doing pickup play. Like, for example, going back to violent wand play, one thing I always ask is if somebody has a pacemaker. It's not, as far as I'm aware in my research, there's never been an instance where, like, violet wand play has led to some sort of interaction with the pacemaker. It's just the type of electricity just doesn't really interact with the pacemaker that much, as far as I'm aware. But also, I don't want to be the first person to have a paper written about them about this. So, like, that just leads me to be more cautious in that area and, you know, concentrate on different areas of the body.
I think it's exactly that it's very important for the top, and the bottom can also be self-aware of their own things, but for the top to know anything can happen from this activity. Like, you know, even things that might seem benign, of course you can't control all of the variables. And I think that's not to say don't engage in kink because kink is a scary thing, like that, you know, because of that. It just means like, okay, we're really going to think about the potential risks and how much of a risk do we want to take on. And I think that's where, like, a lot of people that I've talked to who are disabled, when they disclose their disability, invariably they get less play partners because less people are willing to take on the risk of playing with someone who is more prone to injury or complications.
Yeah.
So to some degree, like, I think it's very variable based off of, like, the scene and the disability. The other thing, and we had mentioned this, so this is actually our second time recording this because our first time, the audio got totally deleted by mistake. But in our first run of this, G, you had said, like, it can also depend upon, like, the community.
Yeah, if there's, like, awareness in the community about disability and about playing with disability, I feel like that would make a big difference in whether you disclose or not.
Absolutely. And if there's more people who are out as disabled, maybe you might feel a little bit more, oh, this is a safe space to disclose this. So I do think that there is some amount of agency that is taken away from, or, you know, everyone gets to consent, of course, but it is, from all the conversation I've had with disabled folks, it does feel like, from their perspective, that agency could be taken away. And so this is a quote from an article that I will also post in the show notes. It says, "Beyond any physical barriers, the biggest obstacles for disabled people exploring their kinky side are the misconceptions around disabled sexuality. These inaccurate beliefs have historically stereotyped the community as asexual, undesirable, or fetishization of disabled sexuality and BDSM in our society has unfortunately affected people's willingness to try it out." And that's whether or not it's a top who is willing to play with a disabled bottom, or any situation. It might be the person who's seeking, who wants to do kink and is like, oh, well, I just automatically can't do that because, going back to, like, community and representation, like, disabled people don't exist in these spaces. So this is a quote from Emerson Karsh, who is a US-based sex and kink educator. And they say, "We do not see a lot of representation of BDSM in society. And the representation that we do get is unfortunately centered around white, able-bodied, heterosexual practitioners, which creates barriers to trying it out." It's very much like a cycle, right? So, like, what we see being portrayed in the media in kink is not inclusive of these other identities.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not hard to, I mean, even though the fact that I think kink has sort of gained a little bit more mainstream cultural acceptance, you know, when we first started this podcast, one of the very first things we talked about was 50 Shades of Grey, which is just filled with white people. And so I do think it makes it harder to sort of imagine yourself in that scenario.
Absolutely. And I think you also had mentioned, like, on FetLife, which is a kink platform where there's a lot of pictures, you know, the pictures that you're seeing.
Oh, yeah. It's filled with, you know, young, white, beautiful rope bunnies, or at least it used to be. I've not checked in a while.
Yes, stereotypically, or, like, societally beautiful. It's, like, very much the, you know, whatever society is valuing.
Yes. Also, I think last time we briefly described what rope bunnies was.
Yeah, let's describe what a rope bunny is for those who don't know what it is. So, G?
So, you know, this is coming from somebody who doesn't actually do a lot of rope. A rope bunny, to my understanding, is basically a bottom who almost exclusively does rope, and especially it wants to do the kind of rope bottoming that leads to beautiful pictures being taken of them, like shibari and the like.
Yeah, I would say from my experience, having been or identified sort of as a rope bunny, I would say my experience slash definition is a little different because I think it's just someone who really enjoys to bottom for rope. And I didn't mind having pictures taken, but it wasn't necessarily the goal of rope bottoming for me. And theoretically, a rope bunny could be anyone of any gender, age, race, size, ability or disability. It could be anybody. But the prevalent
stereotype,
the prevalent image that we get is that that person is young,
white, conventionally attractive, AFAB,
heterosexual, etc.
Cisgender.
Yes. So, absolutely. So, these are also barriers to engaging in kink. And, you know, I also wanted to extend this to that, like, tops in, disabled tops are equally not as recognized. Although you have a great article, we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a second, that highlights a top who is disabled and engaging in kink.
Yeah.
So there definitely needs to be even more awareness around topping as a disabled person.
Yeah. But I do see this note here about crip time.
Yeah, crip time. So this was something that came out of my research. Like, we do a lot of research for these episodes. And one of the things that I came across, which I didn't know even as a disabled person, is crip time, which is constructed from a reclaimed term that highlights the relationship between disability and time. In particular, it often refers to the extra time needed for accommodations. So the translation in a kink scene for me is that be ready for things to take a little longer, you know? Block off more time for a scene and more time for aftercare if aftercare is desired. And we had also been talking about how it could be that you might be prepared for the scene to end sooner than you thought, or maybe the scene can't go on as long as you want, because I know for me as a top, like flogging for an extended period of time, it really bothers my shoulder. And so I can't necessarily flog someone for as long as I would really like. So that might be another idea of crip time.
Yeah, it just sort of, I think, emphasizes that some things are going to take longer. Some things are just going to take more energy out of you than you expect. And you can't always, and you got to be able to plan around that.
Absolutely. I know for me, like, coping with my disability is tiring. It's very exhausting. Which also means that, like, sometimes when we actually have energy, we want to do all the things, and that can backfire. So I know, yeah, have you experienced that, G?
Yeah, definitely to an extent where it's like, oh, I'm feeling good, so let me just get some stuff done. And then I run out of energy, and it's like, all right, well, I'm halfway through cleaning the pantry, but I'm tired now, so I'm just going to leave everything out in the kitchen.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, you... I think it's good to want to do things with the energy you do have, and also just be mindful to pace yourself. And that can definitely apply to kink. So yes, this leads into this article, because I had mentioned that tops who are disabled are often not as maybe recognized within the kink scene. I mean, disabled people, first off, are just not as recognized or accommodated or included. But tops are particularly not. And so I was happy to see this article that you found.
Yeah, so this article, I found it interesting that the author uses kink as a form of role reversal as a top. Essentially, when they're doming, they are the person who is in less pain and has more mobility than the other person, which I found very interesting from sort of like a psychological perspective.
Absolutely. I love that kink is ripe for these role reversals. It is ripe for these paradigm shifts. We get this amazing ability to reclaim our various identities, to reclaim our abilities, and so on. So when I was thinking about this, you know, being a top, it's like, yeah, if you are disabled and you're in pain and you have mobility challenges, and then you are able to do a scene where you have someone in bondage, and you're inflicting pain on them, whoa.
Yeah.
So that can definitely be therapeutic.
It can be therapeutic, but it is, I think we've said this before, kink is not therapy. And while you can find catharsis?
Catharsis.
Catharsis, thank you.
You got it.
The word just, I knew how to pronounce the word, but it slipped my mind. You can find catharsis in kink, but you should still actually do therapy.
Absolutely. The other very interesting note that came from this article, G, and of course we'll be posting it in the show notes, is around this attraction to disability, which I was not imagining when we originally discussed this episode. And so...
Yeah, so I wanted to definitely emphasize this point because there are sort of some... So there are people who are attracted to disability, and we'll include the Wikipedia article about that, which goes into also the various specific philias that can happen in that sort of umbrella term of attraction to disability. But one thing the article, that the author wanted to note in this article was that it's not okay to just fetishize a person without their consent. It's, if that's something that they are up for and everybody consents to the scene, that's great. But this also falls into sort of, I consider sort of a similar thing as like race play, where it, I just don't think it's a good thing to do in like a public venue or at a public club, just because even though it might be fine for the participants who are all informed and consenting, if you're just suddenly exposed to that and you weren't expecting that at a public venue, that leads and that like triggers your trauma, that it becomes problematic.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think certain types of play, especially ones that revolve around our various complex identities and social dynamics that can have an impact on, you know, those things, caution should definitely be had when involving third parties. So I think we've given a good background to the interaction between disability and kink.
Yes. And I think now we want to talk about the sort of specifics of how kink and disability interact with each other.
Yeah, so now we're going to go into a couple. Of course, we can't cover all disabilities in this episode. We're not medical professionals and we don't have all these experiences, but I can speak from some of my own experiences as well as things that I've heard from other people. So the first big one is musculoskeletal problems and how that impacts scenes. And so this can be from any perspective in a scene, any side of the slash, so to speak. This can include joint issues, muscle aches, hypermobility, and so on. And so I think there's increasingly knowledge around how to accommodate musculoskeletal issues in kink. I've seen a number of classes on how to tie rope for people with hypermobility, because people with hypermobility are more likely to have subluxations, which are partial dislocations, or full-on dislocations. And so there's been an increasing number of classes available.
Yeah, I think it's, I think especially in, I want to say in like the last 5 or so years, there's been sort of a big push for the rope community to recognize that there are different kinds of bodies and how to, what are the best ways to do rope with different kinds of bodies, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've definitely seen that. And I think it would be great for this to be extended to various other realms of kink.
Yeah.
Rope is just the one that, I don't know if it's that the majority of kinksters practice rope or...
It definitely kind of feels like when you're entering the kink scene, it's definitely one of the first ones you're presented with. And I think it's definitely one of the ones that has the most cultural recognition next to something like flogging. It's one of those things where, like, if you see somebody tied up in an intimate scenario, it's like, oh, this is instantly, you recognize it as kinky. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for, you know, besides, you know, also if you have some sort of, as a top, if you, like, are like me and you just can't tie a knot to save your life, or if you have problems with fine motor control, there are alternative bondage to rope, such as chains or leather cuffs.
Even some types of, like, not duct tape, but there is a type of tape that's used in kink, right?
So there's medical tape you can use. So there was a brief while where I was, like, really into the idea of mummification. So I took, like, way too many classes about it.
That's really cool. Also, your volumes are a little low when you said I took way too many. I took a lot of classes about it. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay. So, yes, I took way too many classes about it. And what often the most popular form of mummification is using basically plastic wrap and then putting the tape on top of the plastic wrap. This reduces the chance of an allergy, like if you're allergic to something in the adhesive of the tape causing a bad reaction.
That makes sense. Yeah, so there are other things that you can use besides rope to do bondage, obviously. And rope, you know, it, as you're mentioning, it can also be difficult for the top if they have certain issues or maybe they're just not inclined. So, you know, having a lot of options available for bondage and not seeing, I think what happens is like rope gets, like you're saying, it's the image. It's like, oh, that's kinky. And it's okay to use things that are not rope to do bondage.
Yeah, as somebody who is very bad at tying knots, I approve this message of using alternatives to rope.
So yeah, musculoskeletal problems, joint issues, muscle aches, all of these things, and like thinking about how to accommodate yourself in whatever position you are in, what meds, you know, you should have on hand or that you should be taking, you know, preventatively. If there's any kind of like stretching or strengthening that you can do to help with joints or something like that, that's helpful, you know, make sure that you're doing the coping skills to deal with these.
Yeah.
And something that doesn't get discussed a lot, it got brought up in the Discord server that G and I run, and which is also run by fans. So like we definitely rely on you folks to help keep it going. So we'll also drop the invitation, the application link in the show notes. And I do apologize that I'm often so late on adding people to the Discord, but I'm also dissertating. And so we want you, and I'm slow and I apologize. But some
didn't realize dissertating was a state of being.
Oh yeah, it's a state. It's a whole. It actually becomes like you're ascending to another level, or actually it's more like you're descending into hell. But dissertating. So yes, it is a state. And so this got brought up in the Discord, which is autonomic issues. And just to give the sort of definition of autonomic dysfunction, somebody with autonomic dysfunction has a condition where the nerves that control vital functions like heart rate, blood pressure, and digestion are damaged. And so certain people might be prone to autonomic issues. And this might interact with like breath play and passing out. And so I wanted to give a little bit of an anecdote that I also gave in the Discord, which was, you know, I was in a scene. I'm not diagnosed with autonomic issues, but I have some symptoms of like, if I get up too quickly, I feel a little faint, for example. But I'm not diagnosed with, that's often associated with what's called POTS, which I forget everything that stands for, but I'm, again, not diagnosed. And so I was in a breath play scene with someone and he did not mean to make me pass out, but I passed out. He continues to apologize to this day. And it's so funny because I don't even remember it. You know, right? Like just one moment I'm there and one moment, oh, okay, I'm in a different position now. And he, you know, did all the things to make sure that I was okay. And so he was more scared about the situation than I was. And I certainly didn't anticipate it. And if I had been diagnosed, I might have disclosed, hey, this is an extra risk.
Yeah, I definitely feel like that's one of those scenarios where it's good to disclose for everyone's safety, including the tops, because
absolutely,
you know, tops also deserve to have informed consent when it comes to scenes.
Absolutely. And you were talking about how like breath play is just not a risk that you're personally willing to take.
Yeah, so there was definitely a while where I was very interested in breath play, and you know, I still think it's kind of hot from like a fantasy perspective. But after taking quite a number of classes about breath play, as far as I could determine from both what I learned in classes and from my own research, there is a very, very low, but there is a risk every time you do breath play, even if you've done it safely like hundreds of times before, that a medical emergency can happen and somebody could possibly die from the medical complications. And well, you know, that can be exacerbated by underlying conditions. And it was just like, yeah, I find the fantasy hot, but I just don't think I could I don't think I could really live with myself if, like, I ended up causing, you know, real medical harm or, God forbid, the death of a partner through breath play.
Absolutely. The risk is quite great.
So, yeah, from what I gather, the actual, like, risk of it happening is quite low, but there's no, like, it's not, like, a matter of technique, right? It's kind of random chance, if that makes sense. That kind of, and it's the random chance. It's like, if it was a matter of, like, oh, like, if I could spend enough time practicing my technique and, like,
then the chance would go down.
And the chance would go down, and the answer is no. It literally doesn't matter. It's just...
Mm-hmm. That's quite scary. Yeah, I personally take risks doing breath play because I like it. I don't engage in it all the time, but yeah, just being aware that that's a risk and that certain people with certain conditions might be more prone to complications from breath play. Something that came up in the Discord was that, you know, because it is so risky, like it's extra risky for certain people with these autonomic conditions to do like breath play, for example, that can be actually more enticing, right? So actually engaging in any of this can become more enticing because, oh, the risk is really there. And so again, you know, just being honest with people about like, I have this condition, I'm still willing to participate or I'm not. And, you know, part of that could be, oh, I get to experience this even slightly greater risk. This is not saying that everybody who has autonomic issues is going to have complications with breath play. So.
Yeah, I mean, from what I've given to understand, like autonomic issues include stuff like, from what you're describing here, like IBS, which is not related to breath play.
You know what? I don't know if IBS actually counts under autonomic dysfunction.
Sorry, I just saw that
the digestion can damaged. Be impacted. Yeah, so there can be certain digestive issues that occur. I don't think that IBS is normally caused by autonomic dysfunction, though.
Okay.
Yes. But yeah, you could have just a digestive issue.
Yeah, which isn't going to affect your breath play risks. But yeah, I mean, for some people, the risk is the attraction. It's like, you know, it's why some people go skydiving and some people participate in exhibitionist sex, like, you know, where it's like the chance of getting risk is what the chance of getting caught is the exciting factor.
Right. And the amount of classes and materials that are for things like autonomic dysfunction, there's not as much. And because G and I are not doctors, we can't really give advice on this sort of thing.
Yeah. Just as a reminder to our audience, folks, I did drop out of college twice.
And I am not becoming that kind of doctor. So unfortunately, you know, you should definitely, if you're really concerned, then you should consult a medical professional. And I do think that there should be more classes on that. Now, another thing that does not have a lot of classes about it, but I did go to one on it, was on seizures in kink. I don't personally experience seizures, although chronic migraines, migraines in general, are a cousin of seizure.
Okay. I mean, it makes sense. They're both, like, neurological.
They're both neurological. And I went to a class on how to manage. They experienced seizures, and they were talking about how they have to cope with seizures in the kink realm, but also training other people and, like, noticing signs of a seizure and what to do if someone in a scene has a seizure. So we can all benefit from taking classes like that. And then if somebody says, like, I'm prone to seizures, oh, now I have this knowledge of, like, if you have a seizure, I know what to do.
Yeah.
So you can take classes outside of the realm of kink that can help with a number of these things, but there are very few specifically kink-centered,
Yeah, kink-related classes. So when I saw this note, what it reminded me of was the Incredibles movie, the second Incredibles movie, because there's a moment where it just starts flashing white and black lights at you. And it's jarring. It triggered a lot of people's and they just did not post a warning about that in the movie at all. There are definitely people who had seizures because of it, and they had to, like, put that warning into the film. So, you know, it's definitely something that it does affect people, and you should be mindful of it.
Absolutely. And I think this comes down to communicating. you know, like making sure people know and are aware of specific things that might happen. So communicating with your play partners, being more self-aware of your own triggers. So if you know certain things tend to trigger a seizure, a migraine attack, a panic attack, those types of things, just being a little bit more self-aware, and more people getting trained on how to read the signs and being, you know, trained in safety precautions. One other big thing, and I have personal experience with this one, is allergies. And I know you also have an experience, G, around allergies and kink. And so allergies and sensitivities are another thing can definitely impact scenes. And when I think about this, I think about like wax play comes to mind, especially because sometimes waxes are scented. Sometimes they're colored. They have dyes you might be allergic to. Different types of wax, for example, soy or paraffin. I also think about rope allergies. So for example, some people are sensitive to grasses, so jute. Some people have a hemp allergy, and so you might want to avoid these types of things. But also, going even beyond that, people will oil their ropes frequently to keep their ropes in a good condition.
Yeah.
And the oil could be from something you're allergic to.
Yeah, because aren't a lot of oils like derived from nuts?
Nuts, and there might also be in different oils, like I'm thinking like maybe like herbs or something like that. I'm not sure if that's true, but I'm just thinking of like things that I've seen.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and I imagine that like a lot of people would avoid essential oils, but you don't know. Like maybe something does contain an essential oil that could be something that you're allergic to. And so this other thing that I found out recently from my allergist is that I have dermatographia.
I already know the answer to this because it's the second time we've done this episode. But what is dermatographia?
Yeah, gee. So dermatographia, because I didn't know what it was before my allergist. She was just sitting there and we were talking about all of my allergies. And she goes, oh, let me just try something out. And so she gets these two wooden rods and she draws them across my skin. And there was red marks and they just weren't going away. And it's not like she didn't do anything hard. She didn't like make me, you know, try to make me bleed. She just ran them. I mean, it has to be some amount of pressure. It wasn't like nothing, right? It wasn't just like tickling. It was like actually dragging it across the skin, basically causing a scratch. And this caused this, what she describes as this is like an allergy, essentially, because your histamines are actually responding to the pressure. So when people scratch on me or like knife play and things like that, flogging, whatever, that kind of pressure or scratching causes increased redness. And so people, tops used to say, like, oh, you mark so beautifully. And now I'm like, haha, it was an allergic reaction all along.
You fool.
Yeah, it wasn't your handiwork.
Man, that would be the ultimate brat reversal. It's like, ah, you have such beautiful marks. You fool, it's my dermatographia.
Yeah, when I found this out, it also makes me think, like, maybe that's why I'm more sensitive to physical pain.
Yeah.
Because my skin is becoming basically hypersensitive. These histamines are going to my skin. Mm-hmm. And so I'm more sensitive. So that's some aspects of allergies that can interfere with play or interact with play. And now G will also tell their story.
Yes. So I'm going to talk to the microphone because I just saw my words get very small right there. So yes, I did have an allergic reaction very early on in sort of the kink journey. I just like using that, but I can't think of another way to phrase it right now. Where T and I were doing a scene, and I think it was like one of the first times that T ever topped a scene, and we had bought this sort of edible chocolate wax candle. It was supposed to be edible, it was supposed to taste like chocolate, and you're supposed to be able to like use it like wax. So T lights the candle, and you know, she starts pouring the stuff onto my skin. And after like 5 minutes, I'm like, something's wrong.
Oh, no.
Something is not right here.
So you didn't even know?
No, I didn't. So I stopped the scene and we removed the chocolate wax stuff. And basically everywhere that chocolate stuff had touched was a huge rash.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Do you know what was in it then? What caused it?
No, we just threw it away.
Okay.
It hasn't happened since then, so I assume it was... So since we bought it from, like, an adult sex shop and there's not a whole lot of regulation around these things. I don't even know if there is like an ingredients list on it. It's been a very long time at this point. But at the time, we just threw it away, and I was just like, all right, next time, we'll just use like a regular soy candle or, you know, just chocolate syrup, which I know I'm not allergic to because I just put chocolate syrup on things.
Nice. That's good to know.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't the chocolate part because I would definitely know if I was allergic to chocolate.
Man, that would suck being allergic to chocolate. Audience folks, if you're tuning in and you're allergic to chocolate, then...
You have our sympathies.
Yeah, sympathies. But also, maybe you're totally owning that shit. You're like, I have conquered chocolate because you shouldn't have it. So it's like, you're not tempted maybe? No, I just thought about that more and I'm like, people who are lactose intolerant...
Oh, yeah, we...
just keep consuming.
Yeah.
So maybe you're allergic to chocolate and you're like, no, I'm going to keep eating this chocolate. But that's also still kind of owning chocolate.
Yeah.
Because you're like, you can't hurt me, chocolate. So the last type of disability that I wanted to mention is, of course, G kind of started the episode with this, but mental health. So mental health, depending on like, you know, the type of mental illness that you have and maybe the degree and how you relate to it, all of that, it can be a disability. It can definitely impact your daily life and your functioning in a variety of ways. That could probably be a whole other episode on its own. Mm-hmm. So I think we're just going to put a little note on that.
Little asterisk.
Yeah.
Mental health is important.
Mental health is super important. And also, you know, G and I aren't medical professionals and neither are we psychologists.
Yes. Can confirm, not a psychologist.
So we just want to end with a couple of notes on some empowering aspects of kink and disability.
Yeah, so in the course of researching this episode, I found this very interesting article, which I shared with Em. And of course, the article is talking about how people with chronic pain use BDSM as a tool to both contextualize their chronic pain and also to control their chronic pain. I found this very interesting because, you know, I am a sadist. But also, the article just introduces a lot of concepts I found interesting. I'm not going to touch upon them all. I'm going to be focusing mostly on the chronic pain part, but I would recommend, at least I found it very interesting.
This was a great article. It was a great find, and we'll definitely link it in the show notes.
Yeah. So I'm just going to read this quote here. Kink provided some of the participants with a way to control their chronic pain through creating increased pain, which will be stopped at any point in the near future, and they can both plan for and control through discussion with their play partner and through calling a stop to the scene. And the sense of control over sensation meant they felt a degree of control over their chronic pain as well. I just found this like to be a fascinating idea because partially, I think, so for the most part, when I bottom in scenes, it's very much sensation, lovey-dovey stuff. But when I do pain, I feel like this is the way I approach it, of like, it, I am seeking to overcome it and control it, rather than like the way some masochists just actively enjoy the pain. And I found it as a very interesting sort of mechanism for people with chronic pain, you know, they are able to have these points where they can control how the pain works rather than what it's like in their day-to-day life.
Yeah, I think this is beautiful, and it makes me think of some folks that I know who bottom, and actually it's funny because I think even I'll say it, like, if we get hurt outside of a scene, we're like, oh, or if our chronic pain is flaring up, we're like, oh, this isn't the way we want to hurt. Like, wouldn't it be better if it were like, someone's like flogging you or someone's, you know, stepping on you or something like that.
I think also the nice thing about pain in a scene is that you know that there's aftercare coming afterwards.
Absolutely.
So that might also be a factor.
You know, my pain's been pretty bad lately, G.
Do you want me to contextualize that pain for you?
Oh, ooh, spicy.
So one last note that I want to put into this podcast, unless there's something else you want to add.
The only thing that I think I wanted to mention it a bit earlier and I totally forgot to integrate it is that one big accommodation for me, if you can't physically enact some things as a top or a bottom, I love hypnosis. And I think that, and it also makes something safer. We've talked about that in previous episodes, but that can be a great way to accommodate. So for example, if you can't tie ropes or if you can't be tied up in ropes, you know, you can have mental bondage. And so hypnosis can be a great way to accommodate a scene in a way that won't present the same physical risks.
All right. So one last note that I wanted to put onto this podcast is the idea that accessibility makes everyone's life better. I feel like people should be advocates for people with disability just because we live in a society where we should be trying to uplift each other. But if you need a somewhat more selfish motive, accessibility features make everyone's life better. And I'm going to give an example. So on sidewalks, there are those little ramps for people with wheelchairs to cross streets. That made everyone's life better. It made people who are just like having some mobility issues are using a cane. That made their lives better. It made people who are like
with strollers,
with baby strollers. It made their lives better. Accessibility doesn't decrease the amount of stuff that's available. It increases accessibility for everyone. So I feel like everyone should be an advocate for accessibility.
Beautifully, beautifully stated, G. And to all of our audience folks, thanks for listening. Or thanks for tuning in.
Nice recovery there. So if you'd like to support us, you can donate at the bottom of the show notes.
Share this episode with anyone you think could benefit from learning about doing kink with disabilities, which is basically everyone, since this doesn't get discussed enough.
And with that, this is G.
This is M.
Don't be afraid to love how you love.
Love what you love.
And love who you love. If you'd like to get in touch with either M or myself, you can tweet us at KMPPodcast. You can find us at kmppodcast.tumblr.com. Or you can email us at kinky.nerdy.polly@gmail.com.
So, like, last time we did pre-talk, we talked about butt contractions.
Yeah.
Because I had that whole butt thing. Now they want me to go to butt PT. I'm sick of PT. I've done too much PT.
Have you figured out what butt PT is besides Kegels?
So, they insert a sensor up there. And then they make you do, I'm not sure if it's Kegels. Because I haven't been yet. But I got a little bit more information. And they make you watch the feedback of like how your butt muscles are moving.
Is it Kegels or Kegels?
Said Kegels, but you can call it whatever. It's a weird word.
It is a weird word.
And I think I also had told you that the person who, you know, got the cysts off of my ears.
Yeah.
When she was injecting the stuff to make the cyst go away, because it hurts a lot. And they don't anesthetize you for that or anything, but they're just like shoving a needle in your ear. And what she would have me do during that time is she would say 3, 2, 1 Kegel, and she would make me think that that was distracting, I guess, to be doing a Kegel. But like, I didn't even know how to do a Kegel, so
it's just tightening like your pelvic floor.
Sure.
You sound skeptical.
Well, like, it's like, oh, is it like the movement where you're peeing and you stop yourself from peeing?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. Then I know what a Kegel is. But yeah, she just had me do Kegels. It was very interesting.
Like, I'm doing Kegels right now that we're talking about it.
Oh, because it's just like, someone says Kegel and you do Kegel?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Now it's kind of, it's something I haven't thought about in a while, but yeah.
Like, maybe if this is the stinger, if we're just saying Kegel, I wonder how many people are subconsciously doing Kegels.
Audience folks, if you want to send us an email.
We want to know if you're doing Kegels. Yeah, so I guess we don't need a whole lot of pre-talk because, like, we've already done this episode.